welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. July 4th, 1776, America's independence from Great Britain was announced in Philadelphia through a document that is considered one of the most iconic in world history, the Declaration of Independence. It was written by a young Thomas Jefferson. On today's program, the day before Independence Day, we discuss Jefferson and the Declaration with Andrew Jackson O'Shaughnessy, Vice President of the Thomas Jefferson Foundation at Monticello, the Saunders Director of the Robert H. Smith International Center for Jefferson Studies at Monticello, and a professor of history at the University of Virginia and author of several books about the time period. Professor O'Shaughnessy, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Professor O'Shaughnessy, thank you very much. I know that the day before the 4th of July at Monticello just has to be very, very busy, so thank you for taking time out to do this. The colonists in America were loyal to the crown and considered themselves British subjects. That is up until the spring of 1776. Describe colonist attitudes toward Britain up until the spring of 76.
Well, the colonists, in fact, had stayed very loyal to George III for surprisingly long. The press was much more deferential to the king than the British press a decade earlier. And it's only really around 1774 with what's known in this country as the Intolerable Acts and in Britain as the Coercive Acts that attitudes really started to change. And Thomas Jefferson wrote a pamphlet called A Summary View of the Rights of British America. And that was what first gained him national attention. It was so well written, it showed such fluency. And he was the first, really, to challenge the king directly. One English literature professor said that it reads like someone telling off the king.
But even Jefferson himself thought it was a good idea to stay aligned with Great Britain because of defense and a lot of other reasons, didn't he?
Yes. In fact, both Jefferson and George Washington claimed later that neither of them had considered independence until 1775. In other words, until war had actually broken out. And they had no reason to claim that later. In fact, they would probably have wanted to exaggerate it the other way.
One of the turning points in the relationship between Great Britain and the colonies was the Seven Years' War, or as it's known in this country, the French and Indian War, because Great Britain, even though the colonies fought alongside British troops, the colonists were big supporters of and fought and died in that war. Great Britain had racked up a lot of debt, and they were counting on the colonists to make up for that debt, correct?
And that was a very important reason why Britain later tried to tax America directly. The British debt was so large that it took about 40 to 50% of tax income just to pay the debt. The interest on the debt. In America today, it's about 16% of our tax that goes on paying the actual interest. In Britain in that period, it was much greater.
40%? That is incredible. And the comparison you just made with 16% and considering how large American national debt is, that's incredible.
It is incredible, and you have to remember people in this time period were not really used to paper money, they were not used to debt, and that was the real fear that the country would almost capsize under the weight of debt. It was a big fear in America under Thomas Jefferson. He was always opposed to debt, he wanted a balanced budget while he was president, because he was so nervous that America would be like Britain.
So that debt, recouping that debt, and you know, anyone who has studied American history has heard of many of these taxes that were levied, mostly by Parliament, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But what are some of the taxes that were levied on the colonies that made the colonists so upset?
Well, the first was really the Stamp Act of 1765. And that was almost a dress rehearsal for the American Revolution. There was immediate popular opposition. The stamp masters in every colony were prevented from collecting stamp duties. And Britain ultimately gave way and withdrew the Stamp Act. But if it had persisted, you might have had an American Revolution in 1766. And incidentally, the money that they were going to raise from the stamp duty and any of the taxes, like the tea tax, was very small. I mean, it would have been a tiny percentage of the debt. It would hardly have made any difference at all.
So it was just kind of like the principle behind it rather than the amount of money that was going out.
That's right. I often say Americans really rebelled against the latent danger of tyranny rather than actual tyranny. The amount of money involved in America was also quite small. Americans were less taxed than people in Britain by about one-tenth. So they paid considerably less tax, and the average standard of living among free people was much higher than Britain. Even the height of people in America was higher than the average British soldier.
Really? Like how? By how much?
I think by about an inch.
So evolution at work in the mid-1700s.
And purely because of getting better protein and better diets. And the British diets were in fact beginning to deteriorate from just before the period of the American Revolution.
So Great Britain was a worldwide empire. Here in this country, when studying American history, we've always heard about taxation on the colonists. Did Britain try to recoup some of that debt, any of their other colonies around the world?
Yes, it did. At the time of the French and Indian War, it also acquired Bengal in India, which became its main footprint for what later became its Indian Empire. And they tried to get money from the East India Company, which was a private commercial company that literally ran British affairs in India. It had its own army, it had its own navy, and the British were trying to get more money from the East India Company, and they were much more successful getting money from the East India Company than they were from America. The problem was the East India Company started to go bankrupt, and it was literally too big to fail, so the government had to find ways to subsidize it, and one of the ways was the famous Tea Act.
Which ended up in what we call the Boston Tea Party, of tea being dumped in Boston Harbor. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. We're talking with Andrew Jackson O'Shaughnessy, Vice President of the Thomas Jefferson Foundation at Monticello, the Saunders Director of the Robert H. Smith International Center for Jefferson Studies at Monticello, and a professor of history at the University of Virginia, talking about the period leading up to the American Revolution, and then eventually we'll get to the 4th of July, Independence Day, and Thomas Jefferson. If you have a question, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. So, Professor O'Shaughnessy, let's go to 1775. Shots were fired. There were heightened tensions in the colonies, especially in New England. Shots fired at Lexington and Concord. What were the colonist attitudes toward Britain after hostilities actually broke out?
Well, that really, that changed perceptions of the British. The newspapers and the press played a very important role because every colony had newspapers and they were being more and more widely circulated. And one of the more popular representations was just a set of coffins of those who'd been killed at Lexington, Concord. There had been violence earlier, following this so-called Boston Massacre in 1770, but that was a very small number of people killed, whereas this was many more. And that really escalated into, only a month later, the Bunker Hill, the Battle of Bunker Hill, the creation of a Continental Army. And by the beginning of 1776, Tom Paine wrote Common Sense. Tom Paine was from England. He was an English radical. But he was really the first to argue for independence and to criticize the whole idea of monarchy. I mean, he went beyond simply saying that the laws and taxes were wrong, to make an argument against the whole system of monarchy in favor of a republican style of government.
Were the colonists united at that point? I mean, many people looked at it as a New England war, a bunch of rebel rousers in New England that were fighting, but not in the other colonies.
They weren't united. In fact, Britain hoped that by isolating Massachusetts, it could break Massachusetts away from the other colonies and bring the other colonies to heel. That actually proved not to be true. But the colonies, although not split geographically, were split within themselves. So there were large numbers of loyalists in each colony. Sometimes it split families. Benjamin Franklin stopped speaking to his natural son, Sir William Franklin. And about a fifth of the American population, and you can't obviously fully measure it, but that's the general estimate, supported Britain. And 19,000 Americans would eventually fight for Britain. So the American Revolution was also a civil war. And that's generally true of all revolutions. If we think of the recent Arab Spring, it's often succeeded by civil war. And the great fear is that it'll lead to virtual anarchy, which fortunately didn't happen in the case of the United States.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest is Andrew Jackson O'Shaughnessy, Vice President of the Thomas Jefferson Foundation at Monticello, the Saunders Director of the Robert H. Smith International Center for Jefferson Studies at Monticello, and Professor of History at the University of Virginia, also author of several award-winning and renowned books. If you have a question or a comment on this 3rd of July, the day before Independence Day, as we're discussing the American Revolution, and now we're going to move on to the Declaration of Independence, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Professor O'Shaughnessy, let's move to the spring of 1776. The Continental Congress was meeting in Philadelphia. The first formal proposal for independence was made in June. A drafting committee was named with Jefferson as the chief writer. Why Jefferson?
Well, it could have been any one of the five members of the committee, which consisted of Roger Sherman, Benjamin Franklin, Robert Livingston, and John Adams. Adams was really the most senior of the group, and he suggested Jefferson, which he later regretted, and he was always rather jealous that Jefferson got credit for the Declaration of Independence, because Adams had written so many of the protests against Britain in previous sessions. But he argued at the time that Jefferson was much more fluent and had a real facility with language, which is very true. Jefferson was a master of rhetoric.
So where did the words come from Jefferson?
Well, they were his own words. There's no doubt that he was much influenced by John Locke. And again, Adams was somewhat jealous and accused him in later life of essentially plagiarizing John Locke. And Locke spoke in instead of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, life, liberty, and property. But there are strong similarities, but they are entirely Jefferson's words. And it was Jefferson's decision not simply to list grievances against Britain, but to have those three first paragraphs that really defined what it meant to be an American. He later called it an expression of the American mind. He said, "It was not my plan to try to be original or to add something new, but rather to capture the feelings of the time and what it was that people stood for." And he defined in that language the whole notion of Republican government, government based on consent, which really represented a huge change in the system of government from anything that had been known in Europe, other than some of the small republics that had existed at one time in Greece and Rome, and for a while in Italy.
You know, what is, you know, simply amazing, especially when you think about today and how long a period of time it takes for anything to get done, that this document that was actually, you know, changed the world, was written over a month's time, if that. And it's again, I'll use that word incredible to think about how quickly it kind of came together.
It is very remarkable. Even the list of grievances, which people today usually don't read, but it's an extremely long list, many of which were not recognized by individual colonies because it was a comprehensive list. He'd really looked at the not simply the grievances they shared in common, but the individual grievances of individual colonies against Britain. He wanted it to be exhaustive, and the reason was he wanted to demonstrate that America was in a state of tyranny and that it therefore had a right to rebel. He wanted to legitimize the revolution.
I mean, I agree with you 100% that most people don't read the list of grievances. What's an example of some of those grievances from individual colonies?
Well, one, it was the British taking wood from New Hampshire, which they used as masts for their navy. Others had to do with the prerogative rights of royal governors and the governors overextending themselves in some colonies.
So, yeah, those are a couple of things that are probably, you know, that gets down to individual and specific grievances. And I think it probably would be educational for a lot of people to read those grievances. The draft was submitted for the Declaration in late June, and then it was debated. There were some revisions made, and Jefferson wasn't happy with some of those revisions. What are some of the revisions that he wasn't satisfied with?
Well, he originally denounced the slave trade and blamed George III. At the request of the members of South Carolina, that was removed because they were fearful that it would lead to a general debate on slavery. And he felt that the document and some of the language was changed as well. And he felt that the document was very inferior to what he'd originally written, so much so that when he wrote his memoirs, he just put the original draft of the Declaration of Independence. Another example is he originally wrote, "We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable." And that was changed to, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." There were some 39 changes made in all.
And again, I go
and
back.
Had, yes.
Go ahead. No, what were you going to say?
You know, those were major changes, even more alterations. But there were actually 900 declarations in America between April and July of 1776. And these could just be small towns, they could be individual colonies, but nearly all of those other declarations were simply lists of reasons for breaking away from Britain. They didn't have those initial paragraphs, and there were much shorter list of reasons as well.
And one of the reasons that it was, okay, it's, as I said, that this debate, the first formal declaration of independence from Great Britain was in early June. It took till July 2nd, July 4th to be adopted and to be announced. And again, you think about today, something, it would be very rare for anything this monumental to occur in that quickly a point of time. But there was some pressure on the Continental Congress, at that point. There were British troops off the coast of New York, so they felt some real pressure, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the British had landed in New York shortly afterwards and were initially very successful getting all the way to the Delaware by Christmas. And they were getting so close that Congress, only a few months after the declaration, would move for a while away from Philadelphia. And, of course, the British did occupy Philadelphia at the end of 1777 through to 78.
The declaration itself was not signed until August. Many people probably think that everything was wrapped up and taken care of by July 4th, 1776, but it was not finally signed until August. There were writers throughout the colonies that read the words of the Declaration of Independence to the American colonists at that point, and it was accepted and provided some inspiration for a lot of Americans. What about in Britain? How was the Declaration of Independence accepted in Britain?
Well, there was surprisingly little comment. And there was much more comment among loyalists and the attempt to refute it. I think as far as the British were concerned, the Americans had been intent on independence much earlier. And George III never mentioned the Declaration of Independence by name. But he did talk about these unheard-of grievances that were being pursued by the Americans. And people were definitely aware of it. It was printed in the Gentleman's Magazine. It was printed in the press. But little was specifically said about it at the time in Britain. And I think one of the errors the British made during the war was really not to take seriously and to look closely at the political arguments of the Americans and to realize just how popular these might be. The great error of the British was to believe that the majority of Americans supported them, and they would go on in that belief for surprisingly long into the war.
You mentioned a few minutes ago that one of the revisions that was made by the Continental Congress was language that Jefferson had in there about the slave trade. And there are many who would find some irony in that. I mean, in recent years, there's been much discussion about Jefferson being a slave owner. And, of course, the line in the Declaration about all men being created equal. How did he justify that as owning slaves but writing that iconic line?
Well, he actually spoke out against slavery more than any of the other founders. He called it an abomination and a deplorable entanglement. And he did take several measures to at least try and reduce slavery. He drafted one of the earlier versions of the Northwest Ordinance in which he excluded slavery in the Northwest. That would be the Ohio Territory. And although his bill didn't go through, a later version did indeed incorporate that. He also took the earliest opportunity to ask Congress to abolish the slave trade by the Constitution. The Constitution said that the slave trade couldn't be abolished for another 20 years. But while he was president, he pushed to end it at the earliest possible opportunity. there is some thought that later in life he became less committed. One of his nephews wrote to him and encouraged him to take up the issue, as did one of his great friends, the person he called his adoptive son, William Short. And his response was essentially that he'd done his bit. It was up to another generation to take action. But he didn't seem to have retreated in his views. In fact, he thought that slavery would basically disappear as Americans spread westward.
But yet he continued to own slaves and, in fact, had children with slaves.
Yeah, well, that was the supreme irony of his life, that in many ways his whole lifestyle was dependent upon slavery. He owned over 600 slaves during his lifetime. He had six children by Sally Hemings, who was an enslaved woman. All of those children were freed or were simply allowed to leave. And after his death, Sally Hemings simply moved away and was treated like a free person. The problem for him was that if he had freed his own slaves during his lifetime, it would have been political suicide. There was a guy who did it in Virginia who'd been very prominent among the original group of patriots in 1776. He was called Robert Carter, but he was ostracized and had to go to live in Baltimore. Similarly, Jefferson's nephew Coles had to go and live in another state when he abolished his when he freed his slaves. So he couldn't have become president, he couldn't have been the founder of the University of Virginia if he'd taken a more radical stance on the issue.
Mm. So we're almost out of time. Professor O'Shaughnessy, I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
Yes.
Aside from creating a new nation, what is special about the Declaration of Independence?
Well, I think it's remarkable in really providing America with a mission statement and defining what it means. There are not many countries that have a clear sense of purpose and what they stand for. Americans have not been defined by ethnicity, by race. The language of the Declaration of Independence really clarifies what this country stands for, and most importantly, the idea of natural rights rather than hereditary rights, government by consent, and some notion of equality, although there's an irony because obviously a fifth of the population were enslaved. But nevertheless, it's provided a language that successive generations of Americans have been able to appeal to for their own liberation.
Andrew Jackson O'Shaughnessy is Vice President of the Thomas Jefferson Foundation at Monticello, speaking to us today from Monticello. Professor O'Shaughnessy, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. As you are well aware, tomorrow is the 4th of July, Independence Day, or the day most people point to as the birth of the U.S. There will be a lot of celebrating with picnics, swimming, family get-togethers, and, of course, fireworks. Pennsylvania has a new law for this 4th of July. Some fireworks that weren't legal in the state are now. And to tell us a little bit more about it is Bill Leidy, store manager of Gettysburg Keystone Fireworks. Mr. Leidy, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment about fireworks, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. All right, so here's the big question. What's different this year in Pennsylvania from previous years?
Well, the fact that, you know, Pennsylvania has finally legalized them, which means, you know, all the Pennsylvania residents that we normally, you know, we had a section, all fireworks places had sections set up just for PA residents, which was all ground-based stuff, which nobody, you know, they call the little stuff. You know, they could not buy what everybody calls the good stuff, which was stuff that shot up in the air. So basically, you know, PA would come in here, and you know, some of them would get a little bit upset because they couldn't buy the stuff, and, you know, we couldn't even allow them to even mess with it. So by changing the law, it just made everybody's life in the stores a lot easier, because now we don't have to scan or screen anybody. Everybody can come in and buy whatever they want.
You mean, so actually you would have to look at people's driver's licenses or what to find out where they were from?
Yeah, basically, when you walked in, you'd have to go up the counter. You'd have to present either a valid driver's license or a state-issued ID showing your residency. So if they showed you a identification with a PA resident on it, we had to keep them in the what we called the PA section of just ground-based fountains and ground spinners and things like that.
So, I mean, you mentioned earlier that, tell me if I'm accurate here, that one of the big differences is what was sold previously had to stay on the ground. Now what can be sold and what Pennsylvanians can use tomorrow and other times, that there's something that actually goes into the air, correct?
Oh, absolutely. They can buy anything that goes in the air. So basically they can buy, rockets, missiles, mortars, what we call 500-gram cakes that, are one fuse, multi-shot, anywhere from, let's say, 9 shots to we have up to 177 shots. So they can come in and buy whatever they want.
So, let's get down to some of the technicalities of what is legal and what's not. I mean, I imagine that there has to be a certain amount of gunpowder, for example, or explosive material, I should say, that would be used in what you're selling, correct?
Right, yeah. In consumer fireworks, you're allowed to have what's called a 3-inch, ball mortar. You're allowed 500 grams total. So what I tell everybody is, if they buy a 500-gram cake, that's 500 grams total. So if it has 32 shots, that 500 is divided by 32. So, it has to be all divided equally between everything.
Mm. So display fireworks, those that, already over this weekend, there have been a lot of towns that have had fireworks displays. That's still something that you have to get a license for, correct?
Yeah, correct. I mean, consumer fireworks are considered what they call 1.4. The professional fireworks are 1.3. And yes, you have to have, special licenses for that. Anybody that's shooting them off for that, they have to either have an explosive license or they've got to have a shooter's license or something to even do them.
Mm-hmm. And there are special regulations that came along with this law. We have a caller who has a question about one of them. Jody is in Columbia. Jody, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
I have a question. I know my neighbors and myself have been discussing this. Even though we love the forest, there's concern for how close fireworks can be set off to residents in a residential area, whether it's a municipality, as where I live, or a suburb, a housing development. And I'll take my answer off the air then.
All
thank
right.
you.
Thank you very much for your call. I imagine you have to stay up to date with the laws. So her question... how close to a residence or a building?
I believe, it's varied. I believe the last time I checked, it was probably, let's say, around 100 feet or so.
I actually have 150 feet of an occupied building that they cannot be discharged within 150 feet of an occupied structure, cannot be discharged from or within a motor vehicle or building, discharged toward a motor vehicle or building, and cannot be discharged while the person is under the influence of alcohol, a controlled substance, or another drug. And that's probably a big one there that the police would be looking out for as well. So what kind of, since the law has changed, do you, as someone who sells this product, do you have to give any kind of special instructions to Pennsylvanians now?
Well, we have a handout flyer that we put in everybody's bag that will give you some safety tips and some rules and things like that. So we put that in in pretty much everybody's bag so they can read over it when they get home.
Yeah, we actually are going to be talking a little bit about safety in just a few minutes here. Let's go to Nancy in Harrisburg. Nancy, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sure.
I'd like to know what rights people have who don't care for fireworks, especially when the fireworks now are within your local residential area. Are there noise guidelines that people can report to the police or any any way that our rights as people who don't like fireworks can be protected.
I'll tell you what, I don't know whether Bill can answer that question, but our next guest, Brian Enterline, the fire chief in Harrisburg, is going to be here. So let me put you on hold, and we'll ask him that question. Bill, can you address that?
Well, yeah, that one's a hard one right there because, you know, most places, and I know in Pennsylvania, a lot of them don't have, you know, sound ordinance or anything like that. You know, so, I mean, basically, it really comes into just consideration. You know, so I don't know of any places, you know, that say, you know, that you can't do it. And I don't know of any ordinances saying that, you know, when, how, and you know, how late you can do it.
So how much of a game changer, in your opinion, are these new laws in Pennsylvania?
Well, like I said, it allows, I mean, you know, normally all you could ever do is sell anything that goes shoots up in the air to an out-of-state resident. But now PA can come in and buy anything they want and legally shoot it off. You know, a lot of the other states that they're outlawed, I mean, basically, you know, they can buy it. You know, the law doesn't come into effect until they shoot it off.
Mm-hmm. Bill Leidy is with the Keystone Fireworks in Gettysburg. Thank you very much for being with us today.
You're quite welcome. I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. And with any discussion of fireworks should come some caution and talk of safety. Joining us now is Harrisburg Fire Chief Brian Enterline. Chief, how are you?
I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm doing well. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. And I don't know whether you heard that last question or not, but I'll address it to you right up front. Nancy from Harrisburg asked, what rights do people have who don't care for fireworks, like reporting noise or dangerous activities? Is that something you could answer?
That isn't. That would come down to a law enforcement issue. And, you know, when I think about it, every municipality has a different ordinance that deals with the noise and things like that. So, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning obviously isn't the right time to be setting off aerial fireworks, but up until a certain point, and we see that with displays across the Commonwealth, the ones that were put on by professionals. So you do see that, you know, up till about midnight. I think it would depend on each individual's municipality what their noise ordinance would encapsulate. And I think maybe part of that, some of those laws are going to have to catch up because, if you think just 8 short months ago, we didn't have the ability to set off some of these fireworks that we do now.
So that was one of the big questions that I had for you. I ask, the Keystone Fireworks store owner whether it was a game changer with the expansion of what's legal in Pennsylvania. What about for fire safety?
You know, fire safety, we've everything, as you know, and as he said, everything before was on the ground. We now have a huge epidemic to deal with, and how do we educate the public on those distances that you described, 150 foot from an occupied building? And that doesn't mean, when you look at the definitions in the new law, occupied doesn't necessarily mean that somebody is in the building. It means that it was built to be occupied. So even if your neighbors aren't home, it doesn't mean that building isn't occupied. It's considered an occupied building. So we have a lot of catching up to do, and I believe one of the biggest things that we're going to look at from the career fire chief side of things is some education that would be mandatory to give out with every purchase of aerial fireworks in the Commonwealth to try and protect the public. I think the big thing is, you know, let's face it, we're not going to stop those folks. We couldn't stop it when they were illegal. We're certainly not going to stop it now. And so that's where public safety comes in. We need to at least protect the public and give them the tools to protect themselves and their loved ones.
Do you have concerns?
We do. Just in the last 3 years, there's been 2 firework-related fires in the area. One was actually in the city of Harrisburg. Was a fairly significant fire. It was an aerial, illegal at the time, aerial device set off in the street, which under the current law would still be illegal. Got up into a balcony, started the balcony on fire, and ended up inside the house, displaced. I believe it was 6 folks were displaced from that residence. Not to mention the financial burden then on the property owner having to rebuild and things like that. And I believe it was last year, locally, there was a large display of illegal fireworks put off. The folks brought those things. They put them in a garbage bag, took them into their garage and, you know, caught the garage on fire, which essentially then they lost their entire house. It literally all but burned to the ground. So those are the things that we're up against and facing. So our goal is to get ahead of it and educate the public on what the safe use of fireworks are, and then additionally safe disposal of fireworks, so that even after the fact, we're not having issues.
Okay, when you say the safe disposal, I mean, I would think that most people would throw them away after they've been used, but are there those that are still live and ready to go?
So, yeah, I think some of the things we need to look at, those that are, you know, considered duds in the industry, you know, doesn't go off, we want to leave that thing alone. We're going to mess with that. Wait till the next morning, put some water on that one, and, you know, throw that in your garbage. And additionally, all those that you do set off, once you're done, don't put them right in your garbage can, because they have a tendency to remain hot for a long time, smoldering inside, especially the big cakes. You know, those big 500 milligram cakes are just, you know, there's tons of firepower in them. Leave them out in the yard, hose them down the next day, and then put them in your trash can. Mm-hmm. So that way you're sure that you're not going to have a fire next to your house or inside of your house, wherever your garbage receptacle is.
You have a lot of experience at this. I mean, we've had this conversation before, the 4th of July before. Now there are some additional things that you have to think about. But let's talk about some general safety tips when dealing with fireworks. What are some of the things that you'd like people to know?
You know, I think the big thing with this new law is, you know, try to, you know, the 150 foot is there for a reason. And, you know, being that 150 feet away, I think if we do that, we're not going to see as many structure type fires. The big thing with fireworks, though, when it comes from a public safety standpoint, and when you look at the Consumer Product Safety Commission, the report that they put out every year on fireworks fatalities and injuries. Injuries to young kids due to sparklers and small ground effects is staggering. And, you know, so just keep that in mind. These things are burning, sparklers and things are burning over 1,000 degrees. And, you know, when you look at it, that young child's skin is going to burn rather quickly. And most of those end up in an emergency room visit. And I believe the statistics is about 18% actually have to stay in a hospital or be transferred to a burn center. And that's just for those young kids, you know. So take that into consideration when you're setting them off. And again, I'm not here to be the damper on our great 4th of July, you know, America's birthday celebration. But I believe it's important that we stay safe. It's like anything else that is, you know, when we look at alcohol and things like that. Alcohol is safe to use if it's used properly, right? So we have to look at the fireworks now in the same light. They're safe when they're used properly.
That 150 feet rule from an occupied structure, now that's where the firework itself is being set off from.
Correct.
Obviously, some of these fireworks can travel that distance.
Well, and, you know, so these aerial fireworks, when you look at them, some of them are going up 150 feet in the air, 200 feet in the air. So that is one of the, when you look at the fireworks reports, when these things fall over, so securing them in the yard when you're setting them off is a huge thing as well. Because if that thing tips over, last year I believe there were two fatalities. There were eight total fatalities. Two fatalities were actually due to the tip over of the mortar tube and a discharge going sideways.
Basically, somebody got shot.
Somebody essentially got shot. There was a survivor. And when you read his story, it's absolutely amazing. You know, his abdomen was, you know, completely blown open, essentially, with this mortar. And so I think it's very important that we look at a firm base and make sure that you're not setting them off from a soda bottle and things like that. You have a firm base that you're setting these things off from, so they don't tip over.
Our guest during this portion of the program is Harrisburg Fire Chief Brian Ederlein. We're talking about fireworks safety. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalk WITF. Now, we only have a few minutes left, so if you want to get a question in, call us at 1-800-729-7532. You know, I was just reading a story this morning. Philadelphia Eagles won the Super Bowl last February, and there were a number of people celebrating that were setting off of fireworks. And young man, there was a woman who was setting something off, thought it was a dud. Young man thought he was going to help, walked over, shot in the eye, lost the sight in his eye. Good example of even something that appears to be not working or a dud, just don't assume that it's not going to work.
Right, and I think that's the, you know, it's one of the big things. And annually, when you read these fireworks reports, annually you will see that that is an issue. And you know, so if it doesn't go off, don't touch it. Leave it there. I believe that the Consumer Product Safety Commission's recommendation is, I believe it says 8 hours. Leave it sit for 8 hours. I'd have to look. But, you know, you don't want to go peeking down tubes and looking at things. Hey, did this thing go off? Because exactly what you just described it's disaster waiting to happen.
Mm-hmm.
We quite honestly, we see that even on the big firework displays that we do on City Island and after the Harrisburg Senators games. We've had many of those over the years where they set off the display, and you know, 10 minutes after, while we're still there, we have to wait as they clean up and take their stuff out. And we've seen those go off as late as 10 minutes. And these are, you know, we're talking 6-inch mortars going off, 6, 8, 10-inch mortars going off 10 minutes after the fuse was already ignited. So it is a problem.
I imagine that would get your attention 10 minutes later, and you're not expecting that, and all of a sudden you hear this explosion.
Yeah, it definitely wakes you up.
You know, and this makes sense, but I just wanted to clarify. So for those public displays, there are firefighters on the scene?
Correct. In the city of Harrisburg and most municipalities in central Pennsylvania, that is the case that the when we follow the NFPA guidelines, whenever there's a professional fireworks display, there's always a fire department apparatus on standby for that. And typically, they're also inspected prior to setting them off to ensure that all the safety procedures are adhered to by the folks, you know, the licensed folks setting them off. So we have very few issues on City Island. We've had one or two. I remember one year we were working, we had a tube go sideways, and we had a rather large mortar end up in the bathhouse. You know, thankfully, when Whoa. It ignited, you know, we didn't have the bathhouse on fire. But there's been a few issues, you know, like that. So it happens to everybody. It's not not just consumers.
Even the professionals.
Even the pros. Mm. Even the pros.
Are there some products, some fireworks that you consider more dangerous than others? I don't know whether you can answer that or not, but...
No, you know, again, I think when you look at what the injuries are, you know, still sparklers and those types of devices for kids are the number one issue. And I think we're going to have to wait and see what Pennsylvania's new law does for us going forward. We're analyzing, the career fire chiefs have decided all of our municipalities, we're reporting in any fires or injuries that we record, and we're going to look at that from a statewide basis. So all the cities that have career departments, we're going to be analyzing that information over the next couple of months to see what the impact of this new fireworks law actually had on the fire service.
Obviously, the 4th of July is probably the biggest day that fireworks are used, but with this new law, have you had any fireworks injuries in the city up until now?
Not really to mention, it's been fairly quiet. And you know, and I think you got to realize, and you know, cities are always prone to illegal fireworks anyway, and not just cities, when you look at the suburbs as well. You know, because let's face it, once you set that thing off under the old, where they were illegal, once you set that thing off, and you call, the neighbor calls the police, by the time they get there, it's already overdone and it's, you know, it's hidden. Here comes the police, we're hiding it. So it's always a very tough law to enforce anyway. And we didn't see a ton of, you know, a ton of issues locally here. Now, you know, I did describe two fires that did happen, you know, devastating fires. But when you look at the grand scheme of things, they really haven't been that big of an issue, and we're hoping that, you know, the public heeds the warnings and everything that's, you know, hopefully given out by the fireworks suppliers on the safe use of fireworks over this 4th of July.
Chief, we only have about 30 seconds left. If you had advice for those celebrating tomorrow with fireworks, what would it be?
Use extreme caution, and, you know, keep them away from your house, and, you know, look, have fun, enjoy yourself. But don't make this 4th of July either your last or one that you don't want to remember.
Harrisburg Fire Chief Brian Enterline. Chief, thank you very much for being with us today.
You bet. Thanks for having us.
Smart Talk will not air tomorrow. In fact, there's a WITF music special featuring interviews and full performances by local musicians. That's tomorrow at 9 on WITF. Smart Talk returns Thursday morning. We're going to be talking about a poll by Bucknell University having to do with trade. That's coming up on Thursday.